We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams.
Television is reality, and reality is less than television.
All necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused.
Feature presentation, The Pause Button, with your host, Borzoi Boskovich.
Welcome to The Pause Button, and I am your host, Borzoi Boskovich. That was your cue, but Frank. Oh well, I'll just go on without it. The Carl drop, but if you find it another way, let me introduce my guest first, and then you can play it. But with me this week, I have a couple mainstays. I have European Apache.
What's up, guys?
And I have J.O. Del Rey back again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Got it right? No, never mind.
Oh, it's just lighting the grill. Just waiting for you guys to come over. Have a little barbecue, a little beer. You know I love you guys.
Aw. You know, it's my fault we were late, but I can explain that briefly. I don't know if any of you were ever fans of a sketch comedy show from the 90s called In Living Color.
Oh, yeah.
But they had a sketch that was very similar to this show. It was two homosexual African Americans who reviewed movies. And yeah, I was just on CPT tonight. Sorry about that.
Did they also cover for the Jews?
Yeah.
Okay, well then, all right. It's practically the same thing then. Mm-hmm. But yes, welcome to the Pause Button, where we are the show that talks about movies without really talking about movies. This episode we're doing this week is, what did we watch? High Rise, the 2015 movie that's based off the 1970s Ballard novel. This is actually a donation episode. I don't know if this is what he wanted me to refer to him as, but I'll just call him McNeck. McNeck, this one goes out to you. I really hope you enjoy this one, buddy, because I don't know what we're going to be saying about this. And just a quick note on donations. I'm kind of, because of the unintentional hiatus we took, I kind of have a bit of a backlog right now. I request that if people have anything else they want to donate for, just kind of hold off for a month or two while I work through this. It's going to take a while because I kind of got slammed all at once, and then we had that hiatus come in, so things are a bit busy right now. But anyways, let's talk about High Rise. What'd you guys think of High Rise?
I will again refer to the In Living Color bit Men on Film and their catchphrase, hated it.
Yeah, I would say I wasn't a particularly huge fan of this movie. It was, I think it had some interesting ideas, but ultimately sort of struck out on them.
Yeah, it's, I was planning on trying to read the Ballard novel before then, because the person who, McNeck, donated this episode because he had actually read the novel and he enjoyed it quite a bit. And even he said he doesn't feel like the movie did the novel any justice. And I was very intrigued by the fact that Baudrillard had praised Ballard in, I think it was in Simulacrum and Simulation. He was actually talking about his movie Crash, which is about Sexual Cars, which was later directed by Cronenberg. But you can kind of I know Mick Mason wants to talk about Ballard at some point with me because he's a fan of his, but Ballard is basically for those who don't know, he's a, you can kind of see him as like a 20th century postmodern novelist of sorts. He's probably more famous for his semi-autobiographical novel Empire of the Sun, which was directed by Steven Spielberg. But he's directed very strange fiction. High Rise, from what I understand, is a pretty faithful adaptation of the work, but it does seem to be, the film came across to me as a very cold film. Just a very, like, there were some interesting technical aspects to it, but the it was one of those things where I, as I was watching, it's like, oh, I get that. That, I guess that's kind of clever, but
all right. Yeah, I had that same feeling through it, throughout the movie of like, oh, I guess that's neat. And it looks like the director just wanted to visually depict the most sort of jarring scenes from the movie on a screen. I could already tell, without having read the book, that I'd probably like the book, and that the problem with converting books into movies is you just can't do enough.
Yeah.
You can't do enough in 90 minutes to cover a whole book. And it's interesting that this movie went that way, because yesterday I was on an airplane and I saw Life of Pi, and I have not yet read the book, but I could tell, like, yes, I can tell every part of this that was deep dived in the book that they can't depict on screen, and that's why this movie is lacking.
Interesting. Yeah, I read that book and I thought it was pretty decent, but I haven't seen the movie yet. But that's definitely a common thing in all movies, especially when you have movies that are under 2 hours. They're gonna try to get the most the parts that will translate best to visual, and it doesn't always work out.
I've actually thought about pitching Borzoi on doing a series, or just maybe one long episode where we briefly go over movies that we thought were better than the book.
Oh, that'd be interesting.
Yeah, that'd be good.
I can definitely tell you I'd put the Shining on that one, on that list. But we're not. Let's talk about High Rise. So for people who don't know what this movie is about, because I know there are some people who listen to these episodes without having seen the movie at all. That's your thing. But this is a 2015 British film that's set in the 1970s. And basically, it's about this high rise that people live in, but they get so, like, the high rise becomes their entire life. And over the course of 2 hours, amongst the different plot lines running through it, you're basically seeing the complete collapse of a little mini society with an upper class, a middle class, and a lower class. And you can see it as kind of an allegory, but it's, you can tell that there's something deeper going on here. It's combining a number of different elements of like collapse, of human depravity, of our relationship with our environments and technology. So there is actually a lot to discuss here. It's just for me, this was a very difficult film to watch because I wanted to like it. I wanted to like it a lot, but there was just something that it was.
It didn't do anything enough. I really like dystopian and collapse movies, even ones that aren't that good, you know, and not just movies, but books. You can give me something like 1984 or Brave New World, or even something a little bit more hacky like Hunger Games or Snowpiercer. And I thought I might be getting like Snowpiercer Condo Edition.
I was thinking the same thing.
And I don't know if it's this. I think a lot of the sort of class analysis stuff in this was ham-fisted. Maybe it wasn't so ham-fisted in 1975, and maybe it wasn't as ham-fisted in the books, but a lot of this jumped out at me. And like one part that kind of particularly pissed me off is that the working class guy they want to depict is a like communist documentary filmmaker, which of course that's what some sort of Hollywood asshole would depict as a working class hero. This guy's not an electrician. He's not a plumber. He's not a mechanic. He's not even sort of like mid-level management somewhere. No, he's like Abby Hoffman and Michael Moore rolled into one guy, and it's kind of weak.
Well, the most ham-fisted part of this whole thing on the class analysis side of it is the very end of the movie. So Ballard wrote this novel in the 1970s before Thatcher's rise to power. And the movie ends with the little kid listening to a broadcast that talks about, like, with Thatcher talking about what capitalism is. And it kind of, like, really comes out of nowhere at the end of the movie, where it's like as though the director's telling, like, if you didn't get it, this is about capitalism. Yeah. Like,
and like that Thatcher quote that they used is kind of crappy too, because she's sort of arguing like, should we have state-controlled corporatism or free market capitalism? And Like, what are you trying to indicate here, that this building was free market capitalism? Like, no, it was like crazy people killing each other and like doing orgies, what have you. I don't think that the social collapse of a bunch of decadent weirdos is really an indication of capitalism. And one of the illustrations of that, excuse me, is that we are now at a point of sort of unfettered corporatism, and there will not be a collapse. It is in their interest. Okay, if we are going to concede the point that the corporate state and Google and Globo Homo are in charge, they're not going to let this collapse. They are winning right now. This is not going to topple. And now I'm getting like a little bit frenetic here, but even the very building they live in, the design of it is that is toppling from the top down, like the very architecture of the building they're in. And I think that narrative doesn't work out either.
Well, yeah, I mean, because like, the director Wheatley could have taken, like, if he wanted to do like some kind of critique of capitalism, what he could have done is he could have taken Ballard's novel as a blueprint for that. But the thing is, like, I believe he was a big fan of Ballard and was really one, like, you could tell, like, the way he tried to do it is like close to what he thought was an accurate adaptation as he could. But it's obvious, like, he misread the novel, basically the mindset, well, if bad things happen, then that's because of capitalism. Like, that's like, and that's to me, like, where, why that Thatcher quote of all things is, comes at the end of the movie. When, like, when you watch this movie, it's clearly to me about the relationship human beings have to being cramped into these complex, complex societies of scale. And as they build up, they inevitably break down for reasons that are often beyond people's control, and often because of the way that that environment is engineered and structured. Does capitalism play a part in that? Absolutely. But like, that's like, when you get to that point where you're talking about the complexities of societies, like, making it a pure critique of capitalism is not enough. It's like, it's too limiting. Basically, you're missing completely the point.
Yeah, and this is a very explicitly Marxist critique of capitalism, and it has all of these sort of Jewish tropes. You have your sort of young, up and coming, debonair student, and he's just such a weak person that like, he gets beat up and snubbed by a girl and immediately go kills himself. That's another one of these tropes of like, anyone who comes from anything that's the least bit cushy is a total pussy. And I think that's sort of like a working class cope, to assume that people who come from something, and that was like a chip I had on my shoulder for a lot of my life. You grow up without any money and you just want to assume that everyone who ever had anything is weak and a pussy, and yeah, that's just more sort of ham-fisted, crowbarred in their commie class analysis, which is of course inherently Jewish.
Some of that is the view of bourgeois decadence, but go ahead, Apache. Sorry
to cut you off. Yeah, there. And to add a little more context to that suicide, that was the character Monroe, who was a student of Lang's, who's sort of the focus character in this thing. He was a student at the medical school, the psychiatry school, I guess. And in the beginning of the movie, he fell over after Lang was ripping the face off of a head that they were examining, because apparently the patient that the head belonged to had schizophrenia. This was a dead person, obviously. And the Lang says a line, "The facial mask simply slips off the skull," which I thought was interesting, because it's sort of like, later in the movie, you see people's sort of facial facade slip as things descend into chaos. But after Monroe fell, he got an MRI or some sort of brain scan. It came back fine. But Lang, having been sort of annoyed at Monroe after he had been invited to this upper floor party, where it was like an 18th century themed party where people are sort of dressed like high class people from back then, sort of like Marie Antoinette or something. Monroe really snubbed him at the party. So then he said that actually we did find something in your brain scan. And I think that also is part of what contributes to Monroe committing suicide then, which is a big factor in Lang's sort of descent into madness as the film goes on.
Yeah, what Jo's talking about with that kind of perspective on the upper classes, that's like the bourgeois decadence kind of critique from some Marxist perspectives. That's obviously, there's a lot of different ones on that. It's one that I sometimes will like echo just as a kind of a troll. But the tankies have a view of homosexuality as a bourgeois decadence. And sometimes it's hard not to say like, well, where's the lie in that?
Yeah.
But yep. with the 18, like, I actually really love that part of the 18th century party quite a bit, because that's like, I know they're laying the class analysis on it quite thickly, but that, I don't know, like that was so over the top that I enjoyed it quite a bit, because it's not just that they're going to some kind of royal, you know, just like a bunch of royals. In fact, actually, and you have the character who's named Royal, who's in charge.
No, I wanted to call that out as ham-fisted too, like the top dog, the architect and guy in charge of this place, we're going to talk about class struggle. I'm going to give this character the name Royal, and then I'm going to give the other dude the name Wilder. Okay, get out of here. And now yeah, M. Night Shyamalan's next main character is going to be named Twist, right?
But is over the top as the 18th century party was, I did enjoy that, because it does, like, it's a nice little foreshadowing as well. Like, it's such an over the top foreshadowing, because like they are specifically dressed as 18th century French royalty right before the French Revolution. There's a famous novel, and I cannot remember who wrote it, but the English translation of it is Dangerous Liaisons. It's an epistolary novel that basically shows, and this was a popular novel in these circles. It was a novel that was an epistolary novel. It was basically about all like little intrigues and amoral games that the decadent royalty and nobility were playing on each other in France, and people ate that stuff up. It's like before some kind of revolution or blowback, whether it's a radical revolution or a reactionary one, or like a national socialist one or what have you, there's always some kind of decadent society that's in play before basically the antithesis snaps into place. And that's the nice little foreshadowing it has in this, where you have, and they do it, and it's done in a postmodern way, where these people are absolutely aware that they're, you know, they are putting on the airs of these 18th century royals. They know the history of that. They know what happens next. This is them basically, this is their form of basically irony. They're doing their own little IRL right. Irony posting yep. in this. But what's interesting is that no real revolution ends up coming in this movie. There's no French Revolution. There's no National Socialist Revolution. There's nothing like that. What ends up happening is, and this is where I say, like, talk about this movie being, and the story being a reflection of like the what happens when societies become too complex and people's relationship to technology and their environment changes their perspective on things. It's instead of having some actual kind of revolution, what ends up happening is the entire society collapses around them into absolute sexual barbarity, which seems to be more like that's the sense that I feel like we all are getting now. It's like there's like society's not going to have some kind of revolution. It's going to be more likely to just collapse piecemeal, and people are just going to pursue like what, especially because we don't have any kind of moral grounding anymore, that we're just going to pursue our own animal urges at this point. I mean, like
what's a better sort of, so it gets to the point where all they're doing is like trying to chase down booze and all have orgies, and then there's sort of that culmination scene where the woman barges into the room and delivers that classic Borzoi line, which one of you bastards is gonna fuck me up the ass?
Yeah, even as stuff starts to descend into chaos, I think you have the character Pangborn, who's Royal's assistant or one of his men or something. And after the lower floor people raid the pool party of the upper floor people, and there's all these problems, the power goes out. He says, we can't have a repeat of last night. We have to show the lower floors that we can have a better party than them. So they're like cracking down on the lower floors and showing their elite status by having a better party than them and taking all of the alcohol. And also just quickly on the 18th century parallels, or Royal's wife is almost like a very ham-fisted parallel to Marie Antoinette. You have this kind of gross, brutalist building that even looks dystopian for back then, which I guess you could make the argument that brutalism is sort of another reflection of this. It's like an elite imposed architecture style that most people don't like. Most people find it depressing, but it was pretty popular back in the like 50s through 70s. But you have this kind of gross looking building, and then on the top floor, on Royal's floor, the 40th floor, there's this beautiful garden, and you have his wife wearing a bonnet with a shepherd's crook, and there are like sheep in the garden, and she's riding a horse, and it looks pretty nice up there. But it's totally the polar opposite of what the rest of the building looks like. It's very sort of forced, like nice environment at the top of what becomes a hellscape, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And the way they use the word power in this movie, because you were just talking about power outages, again, ham-fisted. When they refer to the power as in electricity, every time it's a ham-fisted metaphor for sort of political power or the power of violence, the power of the government, what have you.
Well, these are the aspects I kind of actually found the most interesting about the movie. This was what my problem with it was, is that Wheatley didn't make it clear enough, and he didn't explore these elements enough. It's almost a little bit too subtle, and I generally enjoy subtlety, but it just wasn't made as clear, because the building, the high rise, is basically, it's been described in the novel, because I was pulling up some material about it. It's described as a spaceship, a Pandora's box whose thousand lids were one by one opening inward. This giant housing structure is a marvel of technologies, which Ballard credits for freeing its occupants. And that the building has been designed to cater to all the physical needs of its occupants, which is why it has the kind of collapse that it has in here. Like, these people basically become kind of boomers in the mindset of, like, because their physical needs have been met for so long, they see no issue with just burning through all of their resources at once. The psychological needs aren't being taken care of, because like what this story is supposed to be about is like a psychological one, like a socio-psychological story more than anything, but it doesn't really focus enough on the fact that because they have their physical needs taken care of, when things start to break down and collapse, that's why they descend into the kind of barbarity, this kind of like pleasure principle barbarity that they completely indulge themselves in.
Yeah, there's the line that sort of the lower class people opine of the upper classes. They've never had the conditions or opportunity to become savage. And then in the very next scene, the upper classes are like partying disgustingly while it, like, in slow-mo, while harpsichord chamber music plays in the background. But I also think that something that has to be looked at here is, so that guy kills himself and no cops show up. That makes the working class guy mad. And then when the cops do show up, everyone's like, no, 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 get out of here. They are still only interested in dealing with each other inside the building, and they don't want to deal with the cop. And I think that is sort of the story, because the whole time you're wondering, like, where the hell are the authorities? There's, like, you know, cannibalism and mass rape and starvation going on here, and people being thrown off of buildings. Where are the cops? Well, that's part of the narrative from the end line from Thatcher about, are we going to have corporate controlled capitalism or free market capitalism? And I think that's them sort of like pointing the finger at free market capitalism by saying, like, look, the government's not involved here, so it descends into chaos. Everything should be under the purview of the state.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, I see it now. It's like, okay, now I see like it as like a weird critique of anarcho-capitalism.
And also, the reason that the cops don't intervene is because it's implied that Dr. Royal is paying them off. Like, when they do show up and he answers the door, they say, oh, it looks like a real mess in there. Is everything okay? And he says, nothing that can't be swept under the rug. So it's a critique of capitalism in that sense, that because we have this rich guy who's the architect of the building, who's like paying the cops off to stay away, that is sort of what corrupts this whole situation and allows things to further descend into chaos without any state intervention.
And you know what? You would kind of have to be an Anglophile or a British person to pick up on this. But given that they explicitly use Thatcher at the end, the British winter of discontent in the late 70s, so a couple years after the book was actually written, but long before the movie was made, and I don't know how the internal conditions of the building are described in the book, but one thing you see in the movie is everywhere is giant piles of black trash bags. Like nobody knows where to take the garbage out or something, so there's just black trash bags everywhere. Well, the winter of discontent was the Labor Party capping union wages, and then sort of the ass fell out from them because they're the Labor Party, right? Labor is supposed to be their voting base. Well, you guys might even be familiar with some of this, but the garbage men all went on strike. So the streets of the cities all over London were piled 50 feet high all over all cities in England. I mean, the garbage bags, these black garbage bags were piled 50 feet high all over the place. And Margaret Thatcher ended up using that as campaign material and shooting like ads in front of these piles of garbage, like, I'll get the garbage cleaned up, come get me. So it, or, you know, vote for me. So it kind of seems ass backwards that the woman that ended up cleaning that stuff up is getting the blame for it in this movie.
That's definitely the director's addition then, because the Winter of Discontent was 78-79 and the novel was published in 1975.
Right.
Now, obviously there were like things going on, but like especially with the addition of Thatcher in this movie, it's pretty obvious then that this is Wheatley's addition. That's ultimately, I think, where you see the most clashes in this. Now I really wish I had read the novel. I was reading some descriptions of it, but
we're doing a movie review here.
Yeah. What?
I'm not gonna let you fault yourself for not having read the book any more than I will let listeners fault us for not having read the book. We're doing movie reviews here.
Yeah.
I don't care what's in the book.
Well then, so I'm pretty confident on this now then, that the parts of the movie that I don't like are the additions by the director, and the parts that I do like are probably more to the spirit of the original novel, and that Wheatley basically misread the novel. He's applying a retroactive analysis to it, where he's seeing like, well, this is capitalism. This is what Britain went through under like in the 20th century. And that's what Ballard's talking about. I was like, that's not what Ballard's actually talking about. Ballard, more than anything, is talking about basically in an amoral universe that we are in isolation in, that is, you know, just digesting us slowly until we all go insane. Like that's what this movie, like, at its best is depicting, where these people, like, because like, what you end up having is you have the, you know, the like the neurotic insecurities and decadence of the upper class. You have how the lower class just easily descends into their own violent barbarity, and then the middle class, which is represented by Tom Hiddleston's character, I can't remember his name, the main
Lang.
Character
Lang.
Lang, by Lang, like he turns inward and begins to basically just break down mentally, being unable to cope anymore with the situation that they all find themselves in, with the irony of it all basically being that they could leave. Well, ostensibly they could leave at any time. I mean, Cosgrove keeps going to work, at least until things have gone so far off the rails that now they're killing him for leaving the building.
No, yeah, and that's more to the point, right, that we were making previously. They could leave. The cops did show up, but they are choosing to deal with this internally anyway.
Yeah, it's bizarre. There's only that one guy who I think works for the television station or something who is still regularly leaving.
Cosgrove.
Yeah, Cosgrove, that's right.
Yeah, and he the first, like, Oh, the opening part of this movie, before they go, like, they show you how everything got to there, when, you know, when it starts in medias res. Like, that's, I loved the very opening of this movie. Like, I was into this when it first opened up, because I liked the premise and the idea behind it. And one of the funniest things to me was seeing Cosgrove, where he's got the TV smashed over his head, his dead body. And it's just, I mean, like, I know that's also a little bit on the nose, but because, like, you also don't know what the story is yet. It's just one of those things of where they're keeping his body around for company, like, that he used to be the man on television. So the only way that they still feel comfort, the way that they feel comfort about the civilization they lost, is trying to recreate it in little, like, in little simulacrums, simulations, and trying to replicate it as much as possible, even though they are burning through the rest of their resources, the rest of the resources being the dogs that they eat.
That's a good point. Yeah, I figure that you just liked the beginning of the movie because Lane was eating a dog.
I was just rolling my eyes at all of the ham-fisted stuff in the beginning. About 35 minutes into the movie, I shoot Borzoi a message. Is this a donation episode? Because I feel bad about, like, hating donation episodes. You know, I'm sure that, like, these people donated because they liked the movie, and, you know, confirmation bias is always fun. And then it did start to pick up after that, but that whole stuff was like, oh, he's got the TV on his head. Again, maybe I'm worn out because all of the kind of symbolism and analysis, like, you know, just straight up a picture of Che Guevara on the wall. All of this.
Okay, that was terrible.
They really hit you over the head with that one. Like,
yeah, three and times. And what's he say? We're going to start a Paris Commune revolution or something, as he's taking the kids down to the pool that they've been ejected for being working class. All of that stuff. Maybe because, like, this book was written in 1975. All of these tropes have since been beaten to death 10,000 times, and I almost wonder if I'm not condemning them a little too much, because maybe in their day they were kind of original, you know, just like there was original music that came out in 1975 that now if I hear a band doing it, I'm going to roll my eyes because it's been done 100 times. But again, maybe that's where one might benefit from reading the book, to see sort of whose fault this was. Like, is there a picture of Che Guevara on the wall in the book? I don't know.
I probably not. I mean, from what I'm, like, reading about the, like, the summary about it, and they try to kind of go in depth on the summary. The part, like, and again, this goes, like, to the parts of the movie I found the most interesting. The book lingers more on just, like, how, because this building provides for everybody's needs, and now they're left to their own devices, it's not providing for their psychological needs, and they are basically, like, experiencing this is the isolation of complex civilization. This is like living in Bugtopia, in Bug City, like that many of us are doing so now, where you have your own little space, your needs are completely taken care of. I mean, like, you're probably financially doing fine enough to basically you're living an existence that's, like, far greater than our ancestors could have ever imagined. And what I mean, like, and we see this reflect. I mean, like, Ballard was basically vindicated by history. Like, what are we seeing as the result of this? Like, people are becoming more and more mentally ill. And, like, look at our pattern of crime that we have nowadays. Like, what you can see in high rise is that this is all condensed into a single building. But, like, what do we always say about America? Like, America is such a schizophrenic country, and the crime that's committed here is just so bizarre and random sometimes. And we're already a country of a lot of space, but, like, as people are being more and more crammed together, like, it's obviously having a detrimental effect on people's psyche. And yes, there's diversity issues with that as well. That's the force multiplier to all of this. Well, that's, like, that's what's the strongest parts of this movie, is that when it lingers on that, when these characters are beginning to, like basically they're getting suffocated from inside this building. One thing that comes up is that I think it might have been Royal talking about, but everyone's got, like, a slot. Everyone's got, like, slotted for a thing. Like, everybody in this building, like, has a role, and even though they're supposed to have jobs outside of it, they actually bring their roles into it. Like, Lang is
supposed to be a doctor. Yeah, you are assigned to a floor commensurate with your reputation, and I guess you could say class.
Yeah, there's that, and there's a scene where I think what's his name? Richard or Wilder, I think Wilder says to Lang, he's like, I hear you're fucking 374, referring to that woman by her room number.
Mm-hmm. And, I think it was Royal that was doing that. I think
they're playing squash and he like shit tackles him for it.
That's right. You're right. Yeah. And but there's just this whole lack of privacy in the building. Everybody knows everything about everyone. Everyone knows who Lang is and what he does before he even right as soon as he moved in, basically. So that's another reflection of when you cram people together. It's very mentally sort of unhealthy. You live in this sort of what's the word?
Panopticon almost. Yeah, that busybody stuff of everyone knowing everyone else's business is also a very English thing because of sort of their history and Puritanism, which also makes me want to reflect. Like, you know, you couldn't put two unmarried people in a hotel room anywhere in England until after the war without it becoming a scandal all over the place. And that also makes like the particular Britishness of the everyone knowing everybody's business thing also makes me want to reflect a little bit on sort of Marxist class critiques and how they apply a little bit differently to the British than it does to Americans. And we kind of have to remember that, given that they had an explicit aristocracy. And the aristocracy, whether they were in charge or not, as sort of your peerage lost power to parliament and government, they might have the poise and I'll just say fanciness of royals, but they didn't always have money. A lot of them were broke, and that's why they ended up coming apart in the end and losing power in the end, is they sort of had to marry into money, and then corporatism and Judaism took over the peerage.
Well, and the bourgeoisie, like that's like this is why the communist revolution, as envisioned by Marx and Engels, was never supposed to happen in a country like Russia. It was still like shaken off the vestiges of feudalism. It hadn't quite industrialized in the way that they had envisioned. It was not supposed to happen in a country like that. They were writing from a perspective like this that their communist revolution was supposed to happen in a place like Germany or England. Mm-hmm. And Marx and Engels spent a lot of time in England. Like this is like that's the mindset that drives like those Marxist critiques, is that that it was in truly industrialized countries, where especially in with the example of England, with kind of the way that the aristocracy had exhausted itself and you had the rise of the bourgeoisie with the controlling the means of production, like that's where they envisioned that class overthrow to begin. And
yeah, because I always like to laugh. As a strongly anti-communist guy, I always like to laugh about this quote-unquote working class revolution in Russia by like a bunch of ignorant dirt farmers. Like, what do you mean working class?
Oh, and the Chinese kicked it up a notch with Maoism. Like, it was even more peasant and feudal.
And then you, at the very top of that scale, you have Pol Pot, where it was just like, kill nerds, eat dirt.
Well, don't give my audience any ideas about me. But what was this? I had a point about the slots. So because you have all these people that like they're supposed to have these slots, these roles, and like you know you're not supposed to be your occupation in any kind of sane society. You're a person with an occupation, but you're not supposed to be your occupation in any kind of healthy functioning society. But that's what these people end up. What?
I'm that's not what these supposed to be my occupation.
this is what ends up happening to these people. They become rigidly attached to their roles and trying to into their slots. And this is where I'm reading a little bit about this description of the novel. Like, I really wish like now the novel sounds really interesting, and now I'm kicking myself for not at least like attempting to, because it seems like a short read to quickly burn through it. Because here's what something that's written about this aspect of it. Ballard, who usually likes to spice up his stories with wry socio-political commentary, does little to hide his initial disdain for the repressed blinker denizens of these expensive vertical caves. He purposely fills the high rise with a wide range of successful and unsuccessful professional and media types, perpetrators of the fiction. Those with a cool, unemotional personality, impervious to the psychological pressures of high rise life, with minimal need for privacy, who thrived like an advanced species of machine. Prime examples of Ballard's obsession with the depth of effect in modern society. Ballard smugly lumps them into what he calls the orthodoxy of the intelligent, a well-to-do and well-educated proletariat of the future boxed up in these expensive apartments with their elegant furniture and intelligent sensibilities and no possibility of escape. He's describing the extremely online bugman types and the people who are basically are boxing themselves in further and further into the where you in order to be part of the conversation, in order to be a part of any kind of impact on society, you're supposed to be chasing this dopamine and being part of this whole thing where you have these people who are educated and intelligent, but they end up being their own impoverished proletariat where you have them as where they may even be making a salary, but at the end of the day, they're just a completely exhausted new working class.
Yeah. There was that quote, I think either during or after the children's party when some guy said, "We're all biorobots now. None of us can live without the equipment we surround ourselves with, cameras, cars, telephones." I think that's applicable to what you were just talking about, Borzoi, and also applicable to the generally extremely online and highly technology-based life that
we live nowadays. If you think it was bad in the way it's depicted by a book written in 1975, if you think the invasiveness of technology was bad because they sort of have these proto Walkmen, the one woman is wearing an AM/FM radio, almost kind of like a bracelet or something, and all of these people have cameras, and this is supposed to be the indication of invasive technology, it's 1,000 times worse than I'm sure this guy ever imagined.
Well, I mean, this is a guy who in his 1973, I botched what the description of Crash was about. It's not about people who are sexually attracted to cars per se. It's people that are sexually attracted to, it's a car crash fetishism. The people, the protagonists are sexually aroused by staging and participating in real car crashes. And if that doesn't prefigure the bizarre turn our culture is going to, especially with our relationship to our technological environment. This is why Ballard remains very relevant to a lot of people. Now I'm really wishing I had read these novels, because Ballard sounds very interesting. He's just a writer I had heard of, but I just hadn't gotten into his works. But what Ballard seems to be talking about more than anything is that, similar to the things I talk about, it's because of how complex and more than anything technologically complex our environments are, and they say it in the movie, people becoming reliant on their equipment, we're getting to a point where not just people's perception of reality, which I always bring up the hyper reality, people's perception of reality isn't just changing, it's their actual behavior and their actual mores. I mean, what you see in this movie is people are descending into novelty sexuality, which again, that's aided and abetted by online porn in our real society, for one. Now you have the VR aspects of that. If people, people were already getting deeply into degenerate pornography before there was VR, so what's going to happen now as they begin to simulate that experience more and more, and people have become very reliant on their cell phones to deliver pornography right to them. Well, what's going to happen as that technology continues to change the relationship to the environment?
Yeah, and it's not just the sexual degeneracy of pornography, but these studies that come out and say that the present generations, the young Xers, millennials, late Gen Z, that they're not having as much sex as people did before. I'm just not sure I believe that. And I certainly think partner counts are several times what they used to be. And maybe the 80-20 sort of Pareto chads are the ones getting all the pussy, but that's no good for them. Every aspect of this is unhealthy.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. What you said about the 80-20 thing, I think is pretty true. You probably have that top 20% of guys having most of the sex, and then women generally having whatever sex they want. But nobody's having kids now, which you do see hints of that already in this movie, where the woman is talking about being an environmentalist, and she asked Lang if he knows what recycling is, and then someone else at the lower class party, I think, says the woman here would help the planet more by keeping their legs closed. And then you have the scene where they, the lower floors raid the pool party at the, that the more upper class floors are having. And was it Wilder, I think, pushes the woman's dog into the pool, and then Lang shows up and the woman is crying because the dog has drowned. And the man who's standing over the dog says it was like a child to her, which is very, very reflective of the type of situation that we're in now.
You guys mentioned the environmentalism, right? The as well, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, and then like on the for the lower class as well. I mean, how to like take Wilder, like, he has no agency in this movie unless he's like making a documentary. Like, he's not able to pursue any kind of actions until he's doing it as a documentary. So he's only able to actually interact with his environment in any proactive way through the usage of media. And there are points where he's like looking at things specifically through his camera. There's a point when he's responding. It was actually one of my favorite parts where he's just responding with that voice, that recording of him just screaming and groaning.
Name over and over.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny too, because all of that stuff leads to the upper class is going to. So the main character, Lang, he's a shrink, right? And even when he sort of descends into madness, he never goes into full depravity. He doesn't start killing people. He's sort of still the most stable man around. So the upper classes go to him and they say, you're a shrink, we need you to go diagnose Wilder as being insane and then lobotomize him. And even though Wilder is raping and enslaving people and killing people, all of this stuff, because he's sort of supposed to be your working class revolutionary rage, this is another sort of ham-fisted thing that they take the guy who's maybe the biggest lunatic in the movie, which is chock full of lunatics, and he gets an official diagnosis that he's sane. Like that's just sort of that's sort of the excuse making, right? Of like days of rage kind of thing. Like, yeah, I'm mad and I should be mad and I should be chimping out because of all the damage capitalism has done to me. There are no rules in the revolution. So if I'm going to kidnap, rape, and enslave the bourgeoisie guy's side chick, that's excusable because capitalism.
Yeah, and it's sort of interesting because with Wilder, on the one hand, you can make the argument that, yeah, because he wants to kill Royal, he's sane because he's the one who wants to change the conditions, whereas everybody else is just partying. But he wants to kill Royal because Royal fucked his wife, and it's actually the father of his children, or of his wife's children, basically. Yeah. So he got cucked by Royal, and that's why he wants to kill him, which is kind of sane. But yeah, when you see him, torture and rape that woman who Royal is also fucking, I believe. He's definitely not a sane person, but of course he is sort of meant to be the hero, I guess, in this, in a sense, the flawed hero.
Yeah, I'm reading this thing, and I think it's just because the director probably wasn't sure how to portray Lang exactly, because while Royal, so I'm reading from this description of the novel here, while Royal and Wilder come to us bearing the burden of their class, Lang is Ballard's invisible man, a tenant who wishes anonymity in the crowd. In fact, he only buys his apartment on the advice of his sister, who points out that the high rise is perfect, as Lang can easily hide in a group of social clones. Lang immediately likes life in the high rise, and once in its embrace, he begins to dissociate from his past. London belonged to a different world in time as well as space. But like Royal, unlike Wilder, Lang rarely leaves the building once the social changes begin. Although he does leave once to examine the unfinished lake in the center of the five high-rise complex. It is not a pleasant journey, as the absence of any kind of rigid, rectilinear structure summed up for Lang all the hazards of the world beyond the high-rise. In fact, as Lang forces himself down the steep gradient of concrete into the center of the oval lake, he felt as if he was descending into a forbidden valley, all of which helped to expose a more real vision of himself. So Lang is a very insular character, and when the chaos in the building starts to go in there. He does not leave the building, but he tries to isolate himself away from it. Like, you can see this is kind of like the, you know, I just want to grill for God's sake, kind of like trying to avoid the problems of the world. It's just like that's going to happen in any kind of complex society. You're going to have this soft middle that they care more about and it's understandable why a lot of people are like this. It's just like, I'm kind of a determinist in this respect. I just don't think there's much that can be done about it on these grand sweeping social levels. But he basically is just, he's got enough that he wants to care about his own little garden, and he wants the rest of the world to basically leave him alone. And that's a place a lot of people find themselves. And it's a place like, and it's not until people are personally inconvenienced in some way that people will engage with the system or engage with society in some way.
Lang maintains his privacy throughout a lot of this. Like I said, he doesn't engage in the sort of over-the-top madness. And then there's a funny scene when the rich have sort of wrested power back from the middle class or lower classes. Royal is trying to butter Lang up a bit and invites him up to dinner. And He recognizes that all Lang wants is to be left alone. He sort of offers him that. Lang's amenable to it. And then as all of this chaos, murder, rape, cannibalism, whatever is happening, Royal says, you know, maybe this wasn't a disaster after all. Perhaps it'll set a paradigm for future development. And then sort of that's the joke, right? Because it does. This all spreads to the next building over and the next building over.
Yeah, basically that's kind of the bug of complexity, really, more than anything else. You have one of the characters, I think they say it to, he says it to Royal, it might have been Pangborn. I can't remember who, but somebody, I think they might have said it to Royal, that I don't work for you, I work for the building.
Yeah. When he fires the guy. Yeah.
Well, at that point, like that's representative of how like the essence, oh, now what I was going to say in a second ago, but like the essence of this building has just kind of overridden everybody else. Like, and it's why like you end up being like, you can't escape this thing, and it's eventually going to affect you on a personal level. But you're like, when you have these complex societies that focus so heavily on meeting your physical needs, but like basically setting you up in just like this mentally torturous kind of situations, like it's going to descend into this kind of depravity. Like, and you have the situation where the upper, you know, the people on top are willing to just let the lower classes do whatever they want, as long as it doesn't personally affect them and their way of life either. And like, that's something we've been like, these are critiques we've had as well, is that like, we're, you know, what are the globalists and like, you know, setting up for us? Like basically like just this, like this diverse underclass that's constantly at each other's throats while they, you know, live the easy life on top there.
I agree with the Marxist critique, I guess, that the bourgeoisie, as the Marxist would call them, don't give a damn about us. And they do a almost comical way, they execute that almost comically in this movie with sort of the matter-of-fact way that the bourgeois go about sort of killing everyone else and stealing their stuff when things get a little bit desperate. There's sort of like sense of entitlement and the fact that they still like put on airs and they still have, you know, poise. It's sort of Python-esque. It's very British in its execution.
Yeah, how they're so casually going about this all and saying, we have to have a better party, commandeer all resources, balkanize the lower floors. So they're fighting amongst one another. It's very just matter of fact. And like, as if they sort of go about their business as if they're totally unfazed by all this complete insanity and murder and rape.
And it's funny because the way the line is delivered too, they're like, we must wrest back control of this situation. So you think they're going to call for like a violent oppression or suppression or some kind of raid? And no, it's, we must throw a better party than that.
Yeah.
We must find the booze and the cocktail onions. And then actually to bolster a point Borzoi made earlier, where there are very overt references to the French Revolution and Marie Antoinette. What does that Marie Antoinette woman Marie Antoinette-esque woman say that they need for the party? Cake.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
Speaking of these over because I totally agree. Like just complaining about these parts where the director's bass was like shaking you, trying to tell you it's about class. There's that part where early on in the movie where one of the lower class women is complaining about how her daughter was interfered with by someone from the upper floors. And what did they do to her? The Financial Times was stuffed in her mouth.
Yeah. That's my kink. J.O., the no good free marketeer, just walks around like swatting women on the ass at the Wall Street Journal.
Well, I mean, yeah, and that's combined with people wanting, you know, what they consider to be their fair share of wanting basically more power in this situation. And like, again, like going to like, what instead if they had if the director had avoided the more like the more Marxist critiques in this movie, if he had focused more on the psychological elements, which just seems to be what Ballard's novel focused more on, like I think this would have been a much more robust movie.
The descent into madness would have been more interesting than like Herder Thatcher sucks.
You know? Because people want, like, you can see people wanting more power. You can view that through a completely economic lens. So, like, everyone, you know, people want their, you know, basically to control the means of production. You can view it that way, but what's, I mean, again, like, because Ballard makes it clear that people's physical needs are taken care of, what you're moving towards in this is a much more plentiful society. So then what happens when people have already gotten past the point of where they need to work hard to be able to live? Mm-hmm. Like now their needs are taken care of. But again, like I know I'm kind of repeating myself here, but their psychological needs are actually being damaged even more. And again, like it's hard not to look at that parallel and see our society. Like, cause that's the thing. Now I remember the point I wanted to make about all this. Cause like, what's the one, like when we talk about like political repression in this country, cause presently they're not throwing us in gulags. So like, I mean, there are extreme examples of people who are basically getting the political prisoner treatment for the most part, but we're not at a point where full political repression, has hit yet. And that's something they'll sometimes bring up as they'll try to bring up like, oh, you know, like how many right wingers have died in this country. Like the point of what we're advocating for, like we're not living in the 1920s and 30s, like in the 1920s, like in Germany, when people actually were like there were people starving on the streets. Like we're living in this time period where
we're living in a time period where obesity and poverty are comorbid.
Yes, exactly. And people are, because nobody feels like they're a part of anything or a part of any place, people are left to their own devices and descending into complete psychological insanity. And we are seeing the results of that, especially like when you look online. This is the end result of all of this. But there was a point, like that was all, the point I was trying to get to earlier, but you were about to say something before I was going on that filibuster, J.O.
What was I going to say? I don't remember exactly. I know that sort of the only take I have lined up still. Oh no, and this does go to what you were saying is help me analyze the final scene, because our working class guy Wilder shoots Royal in the gut and he's dying, and then his harem, Royal's like harem of women, he sort of has his main wife and then several side bitches, they all come in and kill Wilder. I'm not sure I understand the symbolism of that exactly, but I think one of you will, and when you explain it to me, I'm going to feel stupid for not getting it.
So I'm not entirely sure, but I sort of took that as like when things get tough, the women go to the guy who has the most resources. Like it sort of descends into a Hobbesian state of nature, and whoever.
Yeah, are they just mad that their meal ticket was just murdered? Because I don't know that they would have any particular affection for him, because he's not particularly nice to any of them. He just provides. But then again, if they are simultaneously just particularly base people as well as being women, maybe that is the response. You just stole my meal ticket. Now we will surround you and kill you.
I think there's that, but also, I mean, Royal was like fashioning like as like, I mean, like he's the like, what is he also often referred to? What is he always referred to? He's the architect. He's like, he's supposed to be the one that knows the, like, I mean, he built the building and they are basically now a part of the building. Like if the building is his child, you know, remember like the Royal has an illegitimate child, but he treats the building and the buildings he's working on as his children more than his own child, which he barely even acknowledges is his. Like, he's the architect of this. Like, he's the one in charge of everything. And as bad as everything's getting, it's like that mindset people have, like, as we, you know, as collapse, you know, is setting in over time and things are getting worse. Like, well, like, there's somebody in charge. They'll turn it around. I mean, people know what they're doing. Like, he's the guy who knows what he's doing. And Wilder, in a fit of rage, has killed this. So, yeah, there's the meal ticket aspect of this. But it's clear, like, that Wilder's not going to fix what's going on in the building.
Lane, yeah, without the architect. Yeah, so they so love the society that they are in. They so love life inside this building that even when it fall, even when half of them have been raped, they've all been beaten. You know, there's no electricity, there's no running water. They are still rejecting help from the state in the form of police. They still so prefer this microcosm of a world that they live in, that killing the man who kept. He didn't even keep the trains running on time, but he invented this whole thing and he was still the top dog. Killing him sort of, it breaks the spell, I think.
Yeah, he's almost like a cult leader, kind of like the whole, the high rise is sort of his big social experiment. And these women are, you know, like his, his brothel basically, or his what was harem. The word you used? Harem, yeah, exactly. And so even though they're being treated poorly, they almost have sort of like Stockholm syndrome in this situation where he's the guy in charge, and even though potentially killing him could free them from this situation or end the situation, they're
not interested in freedom.
Exactly, because they're so invested now in this environment that they're in.
Yeah, well, I mean, like that's basically the perspective I had on all that. Let's see here. I don't know if I had any other notes on this. I alluded to collapse.
I'm out of takes.
I've been talking a lot about collapse today, so I don't think I really have anything that I said. I wrote like crash with humanity's relationship with technology. It reaches an obvious sexual crescendo. In high rise, humanity has a relationship with the building, with the places that we inhabit. We are shaped by the environments that we also shape. Kind of like a reductive thing going on there. I think I burned through the rest of my notes on this.
So should we do the recommend or no?
We can get into that if Apache doesn't have anything else.
Yeah, I don't really have anything else. I'm looking through my notes right now. I guess there was a couple things that I thought were interesting, like that were sort of like film techniques that I thought were kind of cool. One was where it's at the beginning of the movie and you see this documentary about prison on TV, and then come to find out later that that's probably one of Wilder's prison documentaries. And then there's the obvious, it's the obvious foreshadowing that, oh, this place is going to become like a prison, perfectly suited for one of his documentaries, which he then tries to make. And then, just in the sort of right before the montage of Lang sort of being your typical middle class, almost like middle class white person going about his business and trying to just ignore the insanity as he internalizes it all rather than acting out. There's one scene that was just kind of not particularly meaningful, but it was a scene of all the children singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat. And then the last line is, if you see a crocodile, don't forget to scream. And then it cuts to Lang, and he's on the rowing machine wearing a Lacoste shirt with a crocodile. So it's sort of like, I don't know exactly what that's supposed to mean, because Lang isn't particularly, like, I feel like that would apply to the upper floors, the upper class, more so than someone like Lang, who's sort of being...
No, Lang was the last person you had to be afraid of. Even when he was losing his mind, he wasn't a violent dude.
Yeah, and my final thought on this movie was that I would have found it a lot more believable if all the characters were black.
See, like that, Nick, now, like everything what we're talking about, everything in this movie will make total sense if you add maximum diversity to this movie.
Yes. Yeah, because that would explain, you know, they won't leave the environment that they're accustomed to.
Well, think about whose critique this is. Think about whose critique this is. This is a Marxist critique. It doesn't matter about race. Race doesn't cause conflict. Only class causes conflict.
Yeah.
Only class causes conflict.
Yet it's been Marxism and sort of Marxist communism has only been sort of successfully carried out in these third world non-white countries, which is, of course, not what Marx would have predicted, but that those were the type of people who were like, yeah, let's tear everything down and destroy everything and try to create a workers' paradise. It's interesting. I don't see white English people descending to this state of nature and chaos, but I could see American blacks in some sort of high rise descending to exactly that. So
I do have sort of a one last take, and it's cheap, but it's funny. This woman, Sienna Miller, who plays Charlotte, I have a particular affinity for sort of that 70s British fashion. And in the first couple of scenes of this, when she's in those sort of period stylized clothes, and she's just impossibly beautiful. And then there's the biggest letdown of a sex scene I've ever seen in my life. Like, she's talking through the whole thing. You know, I'm watching this chick on screen and I'm thinking, I hope somebody in this movie bangs this broad. And then it's just like totally ruined by them like having a dumb conversation and trying to make it as awkward as possible. Total letdown. If you're going to try and ham-fisted, forced feed me Marxism for 2 hours, at least have the hot chick shut up while she gets railed.
Was that the scene where Lang was about to fuck her and then she said something like, do I remind you of your sister or something like that? Yeah, that was, that was no good.
Yeah, no, this account came from out of nowhere. I can't remember what his name was, but dude, like, that was one of the darkest, funniest memes I've ever seen. This guy, like, when I was going, like, talking about Collapse today on Twitter, he adds me with this video he made of a scene from this movie where Wilder drags drags the woman into the bedroom basically to torture and rape her, and he has her like marked on that as modern society, and Wilder is the graph from the graph meme, like the catabolic collapse graph memes that we always post. Holy shit, that is one of the darkest things I've ever seen. But I wanted to, because he was like a brand new account too, and just wanted to give credit to that guy, because, like, you know, it's the first time I'd ever seen you tweet, man, you came out swinging.
Righteous.
That's solid.
Yeah, so I don't think I did my recommendation. I'm more interested in the J.G. Ballard novel at this point. I'd probably rather like, if I were to recommend it, like, because the novel sounds really interesting, and I have heard it's good. And I know Nick Mason likes Ballard, and the guy who donated for this really liked the novel. So I would probably put a pass on this movie, unless, like, you're kind of interested in ham-fisted British critiques of capitalism, because it gets really over the top and really, like, you'll end up rolling your eyes at quite a few points. Like, if you're interested in that kind of stuff, or you just want to see like a semi-interesting depiction of collapse, then you can check it out. But I'd probably recommend the novel, even though I haven't read it. Check out the novel. The novel sounds good.
Given that the movie spoiled the novel for me, I probably won't read this novel, but I would be interested enough to read other stuff he's written, because I guess all of his stuff was like dystopian post-collapse.
Yes, loved dystopian stuff. Check out Crash. Crash, like, Crash is the novel that Baudrillard really raved.
Everybody
about.
Drank. but no, I wouldn't recommend this. I think it's a waste of your time, but I am glad to see that people who focus more on a criticism of capitalism than I do weren't any more impressed by it than
I. No, I mean, like, I joke about, you know, my Ann Prim Nazbol, it's like Islamic.
Well, it's like I said last week. You know, I'm not interested in Borzoi and Stryker running things, because when I come back from, you know, conquering Africa in the campaign of 2040, I don't want to find all nine of my wives in bread lines with pictures of Stryker and Borzoi over the TV and the International playing exclusively.
Shepherd Fairey depictions of Stryker and Borzoi over the bread lines.
Yep.
With so the, that's why with you, the gold that's, ring. That's why you hated this movie so much, because the future echo of all that. Like, you're gonna come back. You're gonna come back to the literal high rise with just instead of white people, though. Obviously, it's gonna be black people in the.
People start riding around in wheelchairs just so they can be more like Stryker.
you guys did your recommendation, right?
I didn't do mine yet, okay. But yeah, I totally agree with you guys. I'm definitely interested in checking out more Ballard stuff now, probably his books. I'm interested in checking out Crash. I do like a lot of this dystopian stuff, especially when it can be applied to modern day, but nah, I wouldn't recommend this movie.
Okay, and I know you don't recommend it, Jay. I believe you said as much.
Yeah, I said so. Hated it. Men on film.
Yeah, I don't think I don't really have anything else. So, just housekeeping stuff, upcoming ones. I think, because Nick Mason was supposed to join me for a couple of documentaries that we were going to do. The donator requested specifically that it be released around July 4th, because it kind of talks about the darker aspects of the United States government. So I think we might do that. Unfortunately, I'm not going to have Nick Mason on for it. So I think for people who want to try to watch stuff ahead of time, I believe we're going to do Conspiracy of Silence and Mina. I think it's called the Mina Connection. Two documentaries that they're like television documentaries. They should be easy to find on YouTube. I think we'll do that next week. And since I can't get Nick Mason, maybe I can get Dark Enlightened for that one, because I think that'd be up his alley. But then after that, some of the stuff we have coming up would be, we have Southland Tales, which I want to combine with Donnie Darko, because I don't think you can talk about one without the other. They're by the same director. And let's see here. Just so people kind of like, because I'm going to get emails anyways from people asking, you know, like, have you done this yet? So, okay, yeah, here's what I got coming up. And this might be in order. Mina Connection and Conspiracy of Silence, Southland Tales and Donnie Darko. I got Fitzcarraldo, which, again, apologies to the guy who reached out for me. Like, sometimes this happens, and this is why I want to put a little pause on this stuff, because like, this was a donation from a while ago, and I somehow missed that one. So, I apologize to you in email. I'm really sorry, dude. I didn't mean to miss that. We've finished High Rise, so we got Legends of the Fall, Dark Knight Trilogy, Matrix Trilogy, Mommy Dead and Dearest, and both of the Blade Runners coming up. And I think Rubber is being donated, the movie about the tire is being donated for as well, but that has not been confirmed as of yet.
Yeah, I'll do whatever.
Yeah, I got a very busy.
Why doesn't anyone ever ask for a movie that I already know real well? I always find myself in a rush. There's something about Tuesdays. That's why this show has flaked off so many times. Like, I cracked the whip to get Borzoi to start doing the show on the regular again. Then I kept having to cancel. And now I always end up like running around in a fit and finishing the movie like 2 minutes before we start the show.
Yeah, that was literally me. I finished it like as the show was starting.
Yeah, it's... But yeah, it's, I mean, that's the problem of the pause button, is because I can't do a 2 hour filibuster on my own. Somebody has to kind of slap my shit and get me, you know, to get back on track. So that's why I always need a guest. And it's, when my co-host is also busy, like, it's just one of those things. I know I have the exact same problem. Because you have to finish the stuff ahead of time. Anyways, I shouldn't even be complaining. Like, people are so gracious to want to donate and have me talk about movies. Like, I shouldn't even be framing it that way. Like,
we should marathon it 1 week. Like, do two shows a day.
I've been wanting
5 days and then put it all in the tank.
I've been wanting to do that for a while. If you're up for it, like, let's talk about that. Like, if we can, instead of doing like, then we can, I can release the, like, that actually, like, if I can get a buffer in, like, of a couple week buffer, then I can plan much more carefully ahead of time and do more.
So then when I call out on you 3 hours before the show, you still have something to release.
Well, the way the show used to be as well, is I used to do, and this is why, like, I took frequent hiatuses. I used to do a lot of research for these things. Like, I wanted it to be a very, like, this show to be very encompassing a lot of different like multimedia aspects to it, like where I'm talking about like, especially like if this had been like how I used to be, like I would have read the whole novel ahead of time. I would have had written some research papers about Ballard and all of that, instead of kind of just flying by the seat of my pants on all of this. I want to get back to that. So if we can get a buffer going on in this, this would actually be fantastic for me.
Yeah, we'll work something out.
Yeah. But that's talking shop. People don't need to be hearing that. All right. You guys have anything you want to plug upcoming?
No, we're doing the Europa Report every Monday. I couldn't do it this week. I was traveling yesterday, so Jazz Hands McFields sat in for me with Jay Lorenz on the Europa Report. And, of course, therightstuff.biz/paywall. We've got all kinds of good stuff back there. I can't imagine a lot of people listening to this aren't familiar with that stuff.
Yep. All right. With that, I'm going to push the pause button on this.